I want you to picture a farm today. Like, just close your eyes and imagine it. You're probably picturing this massive open expanse of land just stretching out to the horizon,
Yeah,
right?
classic Midwestern postcard look.
Exactly. And sitting right in the middle of it, just completely dominating the landscape, is this absolute giant, I mean, a 20-ton, $500,000 tractor.
Oh, easily 500,000. Sometimes more.
Right. And, it's a marvel of modern engineering. You can literally feel the ground shake when it rolls by. The tires are like taller than you are.
Yeah.
But, and here's the reality of that machine. It is entirely dependent on diesel fuel, fuel that currently costs, what, around $5 a gallon?
And fluctuating every single day.
Exactly. And that fuel is tied to a global supply chain that is honestly incredibly fragile. So that farmer sitting up in that air-conditioned cab, they're likely heavily indebted, constantly sweating over commodity prices, global oil markets, and just the sheer astronomical cost of keeping that massive machine running for another harvest.
It is honestly an incredibly stressful position to be in
Yeah.
because you've got millions of dollars of capital tied up in equipment, but your daily operational costs are completely outside of your control.
Right, you're at the mercy of the world. Now, hold that image of a giant tractor in your mind, and let's contrast it with a completely different vision. We're looking at the farm of 2026.
Yeah, a totally different paradigm.
Completely. Picture a rural entrepreneur sitting in like a comfortable home office. Instead of gripping a steering wheel, they're using voice commands. They speak a simple directive into a headset, and outside, out in the fields, a swarm of small, maybe 150-pound electric robots silently rolls
I
out.
look almost like rugged little Mars rovers
Yeah,
just.
exactly like rovers.
Right.
And they're driven by localized artificial intelligence, but the craziest part, they aren't running on a single drop of imported diesel.
Not a drop.
They're running on synthetic fuel made right there on the property from local dairy cow manure, and they're charging their batteries with electricity harvested from vertical solar fences that just line the fields. It's a completely self-contained loop.
And that contrast right there. I mean, the shift from the giant to the swarm, from the global to the local, that's exactly what we're unpacking today. It's a profound paradigm shift.
It really is. Welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Today, we're going on a mission. We are going to explore exactly how rural entrepreneurs, people who have historically just been squeezed dry by the massive costs of modern agriculture, are structurally outmaneuvering massive multinational ag conglomerates.
It's David and Goliath's story, but with lasers and AI.
It literally is. We're going to break down how setting up what's called a sovereign power node isn't just like a cool new way to grow crops. It is actually the ultimate financial hedge in an increasingly volatile world. And to help me synthesize this massive shift from what we call the line to the node, I've got our expert here. Today's deep dive is pulling from a really thick stack of strategic reports. We're looking at white papers on agricultural autonomy as a service, the localized energy loop, and we even got our hands on a specific 90-day tactical playbook for rural developers.
I am so thrilled to be here for this because, the implications of this extend so far beyond just farming. When we really get into the mechanics of it, it touches on global energy security, the future of AI, data privacy, and really just the fundamental structure of how humans produce and consume resources.
So let's just jump right in. To understand how this new rural entrepreneur operates and why they're winning, we first have to understand the fatal flaw in how traditional mega farms operate today.
Right, the legacy model.
Yeah, the legacy system relies on this concept of the line. What exactly is that? Because in the reports, it sounds incredibly precarious.
Well, the line is basically a perfect metaphor for the legacy industrial system. It represents a linear global supply chain. This system was built over the last century entirely for centralized efficiency. But in doing so, it completely sacrificed resilience.
Okay, so walk me through it.
Let's trace the actual physical journey of the energy required to power that 20-ton giant tractor you mentioned. It doesn't start at the local gas station. It starts as a drop of crude oil extracted from a well maybe halfway across the world in the Middle East or, offshore in the Gulf.
Okay, so it's pumped out of the ground. Then what?
Then it goes into a pipeline. Then it gets loaded onto a massive transcontinental super tanker. And that tanker spends weeks crossing the ocean, completely subject to weather, piracy, geopolitical choke points. Like, remember when the Suez Canal got blocked?
Oh, yeah, the sideways cargo ship. That was a mess.
Exactly. So it finally arrives at a massive coastal refinery, where it requires staggering amounts of heat and chemical processing to be refined into diesel. From the refinery, it goes into another pipeline, or maybe onto a train, moving to regional storage depots. And then finally, a fuel delivery truck drives it miles out into the country just to sit in a tank on the farm.
Wow. When you lay it out like that, it sounds like a massive, incredibly fragile extension cord stretching across the entire globe.
That's exactly what it is.
If anyone, anywhere, trips over it, say a refinery goes on strike, or there's a conflict in an oil-producing region, that giant tractor simply stops working. The farmer is just paralyzed.
That's precisely the vulnerability. It's what the reports call the entropy trap. Multinational agricultural conglomerates are entirely stuck in an unlimited OPEX model. OPEX meaning operational expenditure.
So daily running costs.
Right. Every single day they want to wake up and run their giant machines, they're forced to pull out their wallets and buy global diesel at whatever the daily spot rate happens to be. And for a large grain farm, fuel isn't just a minor expense. It accounts for roughly 11 to 13% of their total production costs.
That's massive. So if global diesel prices suddenly spike because of a crisis overseas, their profit margin doesn't just dip, it absolutely vanishes.
It evaporates entirely. They have zero control over their primary input cost. They're what economists call price takers. The market dictates their survival.
You just have to absorb the cost, whatever it is. Okay, so now contrast that incredibly long, fragile line with the node, because the node seems to flip this entirely on its head.
Oh, it does, completely. The node is a localized circular energy hub. In this model, power is generated, stored, and consumed entirely within the same square mile, sometimes literally within the exact same acre.
Just a totally closed loop.
Exactly. Because the rural entrepreneur is generating their own power on site, using their own biological waste and solar capture, they operate on a front-loaded CapEx model, capital expenditure.
Meaning they pay for the hardware up front.
Right. Once they purchase the hardware to generate the energy, the marginal cost of producing the next unit of fuel or the next kilowatt of electricity is, well, it's statistically near zero.
Because the sun doesn't send a monthly invoice.
Exactly. And the cows certainly don't charge you for their manure.
That's amazing. So this is the financial hedge we're talking about. By locking their energy costs into the physical equity of their hardware, like the solar panels, the biodigesters, rather than gambling on oil derivatives and global logistics, these rural entrepreneurs completely stabilize their margins.
Yes. When global markets panic and diesel prices skyrocket to $8 a gallon, the multinational conglomerate just bleeds cash. But the rural entrepreneur's operational costs remain basically flat.
Because their fuel is practically free once the system is built.
Exactly.
But hold on, I have to ask the obvious question here. I mean, if this localized node system is so brilliant, why couldn't a multinational conglomerate just build their own massive node? Like, if you're a billion-dollar ag company, why wouldn't you just copy this and save the money?
Well, what's fascinating here is the actual physical limitation of scale. It really comes down to the structural difference between mass centralization and specialized decentralization.
Okay, unpack that for me.
Conglomerates rely on massive centralized scale. They operate enormous consolidated plots of land. We're talking thousands and thousands of acres. And they run fleets of those 20-ton machines. Those machines require incredible bursts of high-density energy all at once during very narrow planting and harvesting windows.
Right. They need like a fire hose of fuel instantly.
Exactly. And localized biological energy loops like generating gas from local farm waste, they just cannot easily satisfy that massive centralized energy spike in real time.
Mm-hmm.
The biology doesn't scale that way.
It's too slow.
Right. The node thrives because it relies on smaller, distributed, continuous energy usage. Furthermore, there's something called the transport tax.
What's that?
In traditional agriculture, 3 to 5% of the total energy utilized by the farm is lost simply in the physical act of transporting the fuel from the regional depot to the tractor itself. When you generate the fuel exactly where you spend it, you eliminate that transport tax entirely.
Oh.
The conglomerates can't do this because their operational logic, big machines, big fields, big bursts of activity, is fundamentally incompatible with the steady state scale of biological energy generation.
So they're literally too big to be agile. Their size is their weakness.
Exactly.
Okay, so if the line requires massive centralized energy, it's because it's powering massive centralized machines, which means if we're going to use this localized node, the machinery itself has to fundamentally change, right? You can't run a 20-ton behemoth off a local solar fence in a cow pasture.
You cannot. The hardware must evolve.
And this brings us to what might be the most visually striking part of this entire shift in the reports. We're looking at the death of the giants and the rise of the swarms. Let's dig into the mechanical divergence first. I mentioned that legacy 20-ton machine earlier. Aside from just chugging expensive diesel, why is that immense weight actually a problem for the farm itself?
It's the hidden agronomic and financial cost of the giant soil compaction.
Yeah.
To understand this, you have to understand what healthy soil actually is. It's not just dirt. Healthy soil is a living, breathing ecosystem. It's full of microscopic life, fungi, and crucially, tiny pockets of air and water channels.
Okay, so it's porous.
Very. So when you roll a 40,000 or 50,000 pound machine over a field, it exerts immense ground pressure. It causes severe compaction of the earth up to 3 feet down.
Wow! 3 feet! It literally crushes the life out of it.
It acts like a giant rolling pin. It collapses those air pockets. It reduces water infiltration, meaning rain just runs off instead of soaking in. It suffocates the microbial life. And physically, it creates a hard pan layer that limits how deep the roots of the crops can grow.
And if roots can't go deep, they can't access nutrients or survive droughts.
Exactly. This compaction alone reduces crop yields by 10 to 20%.
That's huge.
It is. And the irony is, to fix the problem caused by the heavy tractor, the conglomerates have to spend even more money running heavy, deep tillage equipment to break up the hard pan, and then they have to apply expensive chemical fertilizers to compensate for the dead soil biology.
So they're caught in this destructive loop. They're basically depreciating their own biological capital just by driving to work?
Precisely. Now let's look at the alternative. The rural entrepreneur utilizes agricultural autonomy as a service. We'll call it A.
AA, got it.
Instead of the giant, they deploy swarm bots. These are small, highly efficient electric robots that weigh anywhere from, 150 to 800 pounds.
So tiny in comparison.
Tiny.
Yeah.
And because they're so light and they distribute their weight on wide tracks or specialized tires, their ground pressure is actually less than the footstep of an adult human.
Wait, really? That is wild. You could have a whole fleet of these things rolling over the field, and they're doing less damage than if I just walked across it in my sneakers.
Exactly. They just glide over the soil without compacting it. They preserve that biological capital, allowing for deep, healthy root systems and, thriving soil microbes.
But it's not just a matter of swapping a big, dumb machine for a small, dumb machine, right? The reports really emphasize that the small machines are fundamentally smarter.
Much smarter.
Because in the old model, the logic was entirely driven by human labor costs. Since paying a human driver an hourly wage is expensive, you had to make the tractor as large as possible so one person could cover the maximum acreage in a 12-hour shift.
That was the driver to horsepower ratio.
Right. And because the tractor is so big, it can't be precise. The driver relies on macro scale GPS to essentially carpet bomb entire fields with chemical herbicides. They just spray everywhere, hoping they hit the weeds while the crop somehow survives the chemical bath.
It's a completely blunt instrument.
But the swarm bots operate on a completely different level of intelligence. It's a shift to what the reports call compute per plant. How exactly do these little rovers actually see and interact with the field?
Well, if we connect this to the broader advancements in AI, the swarms utilize a high-level edge AI logic. Now, edge is the critical word here. It means the processing isn't happening in some remote cloud server. It's happening right there, locally, on the silicon chip, physically located inside the robot.
Right, because out in a rural field, you can't rely on a perfect 5G connection to stream video to a server to ask, hey, is this a weed? It has to know instantly.
Exactly. The latency would just make it impossible. So these bots carry sophisticated neural processing units. As they roll through the field, they use downward-facing cameras, computer vision, and visual odometry.
Yeah.
They are analyzing the ground millimeter by millimeter in real time.
Incredible.
They've been trained on millions of images, so they can instantly differentiate between a 2-inch corn sprout and a 2-inch thistle.
Okay, so it sees the weed.
Right.
But once it identifies the weed, it doesn't just spray it, right?
No, this is where the precision becomes truly surgical. Because the bot knows exactly where the weed is and exactly where the crop is, it doesn't need bright spectrum chemicals at all. Some bots use mechanical tabs to physically reach down and just pluck the weed out.
Like little robot hands?
Basically. But the more advanced models execute micro-targeted laser firings.
The lasers?
I'm serious. They focus a high-intensity thermal laser directly onto the meristem of the weed. That's the growing point. And literally incinerate it in a fraction of a second, right, leaving the valuable crop half an inch away, perfectly untouched.
It's literally shooting lasers at weeds. That is, I mean, we're moving from treating the farm like a dumb assembly line where we just carpet bomb the dirt with poison to treating it like an intricate, delicate ecosystem where we act as a highly precise surgeon. Mm-hmm. And because of this, the entire day-to-day job of the farmer fundamentally flips. The rural entrepreneur isn't sitting in a cab getting bounced around for 14 hours. They are a fleet commander.
That's a great way to put it. They're managing operations, not turning a steering wheel.
Right. They manage 10 to 20 of these bots from a multi-monitor setup in their home office. They use a software architecture called RIOS, the Rural Infrastructure Operating System, and the interface sounds incredible. It uses a voice-in, structure-out protocol, which they call Move9 in the playbook.
Right. Highly intuitive.
They don't have to write code or even click through complicated menus. They just speak naturally to the system. They put on a headset and say, "Hey, RIOS, clear the north 40-acre field of thistles by Tuesday afternoon." And the AI parses that natural language, translates it into GPS coordinates, calculates battery life and recharge schedules, and deploys the swarm.
It translates human intent into autonomous physical action.
But, and I've got to be honest here, I look at that and my immediate reaction is skepticism. My smart speaker in my kitchen barely understands when I ask it to set a 5-minute timer for pasta. You are telling me a farmer is going to trust an AI to coordinate 20 autonomous robots carrying lasers around a multi-million dollar crop.
It sounds risky, right?
Yeah. Isn't managing 20 individual, highly complex robots exponentially harder and riskier than just keeping one big diesel engine running?
It is entirely counterintuitive, I grant you that. But the math and the operational reality prove the exact opposite. And this brings us to a really vital concept, anti-fragile infrastructure.
Okay, lay it on me.
Let's examine the risk profile of the giant. Say you own a $600,000 massive tractor. You're in the middle of a critical, time-sensitive planting window. If a single proprietary sensor fails, or a hydraulic line bursts, or the transmission locks up, what happens?
The tractor stops.
Yes. 100% of your operation is dead in the water. You have a single point of catastrophic failure. You're losing thousands of dollars every single hour. It sits there waiting for a specialized technician to drive out from three counties away with the proprietary part.
Ugh, that's a nightmare.
Now consider the swarm. You have 20 independent bots operating simultaneously. If one bot breaks an axle or gets mud on its camera or has a battery failure, what happens?
Well, the other 19 keep going.
Exactly. Yeah. You still retain 95% of your operational capacity. The work never stops. The system sends an alert to RIOS. A smaller retrieval bot or an ATV goes out, picks up the broken 150-pound node, and swaps it with a spare sitting in the barn. It takes like 15 minutes.
Wow.
That is decentralized resilience. It is anti-fragile because small localized failures do not bring down the macro system.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. The redundancy is just built in. And this structural resilience is what enables the whole financial model to work for the rural entrepreneur. Because they aren't necessarily buying these robots to farm their own land, right? They're operating them as a service for other farmers in the region.
Correct. The rural developer becomes a service provider. They don't walk onto a neighbor's farm and try to sell them a robot. Farmers are notoriously averse to taking on new capital debt.
Right.
Instead, they offer a service contract. They charge a flat fee per acre, maybe $20 to $50, to handle all the weeding or seeding for the season. Or there's an even more lucrative model, revenue sharing based on input reduction.
How does that work?
Well, let's say a traditional farm spends $100,000 a year on chemical herbicides. The rural entrepreneur comes in and says, "My laser swarms will handle your weeds. You don't buy any chemicals this year. In exchange, I take a 30% cut of whatever you save."
Oh, that's brilliant.
The farmer instantly saves $70,000, takes on absolutely no debt for new equipment, and improves their soil health. Meanwhile, the entrepreneur running the swarm pockets $30,000 in pure service revenue. With a fleet of 20 bots running continuously, they're operating a highly lucrative, cash flow positive business.
It is a total alignment of incentives. Everyone wins. But this brings us to the absolute core of the issue. We have these amazing laser-shooting, soil-saving swarm bots, and we know they run on electricity, but how do we power them?
Ah, the million-dollar question.
Because if the entrepreneur just plugs these robots back into the traditional centralized utility grid, or if they fire up a massive diesel generator to charge the batteries, we haven't actually solved anything. We're right back in the entropy trap. We're still at the mercy of the line. We just added a battery to it.
Precisely. You cannot achieve true sovereignty if you are tethered to someone else's fragile power source. And this is where the engineering gets truly spectacular. This is the localized energy loop, or the LEL.
Let's get into the mechanics of this, because it sounds like alchemy when you read it. The LEL is the beating heart of the sovereign node. It's an architecture built on two primary pillars that work in perfect synergy, a biological pillar and an electrical pillar.
Mm-hmm.
Let's break down the biological pillar first. This is called the molecular loop, and it starts with the most unglamorous resource on the farm, manure.
It does. But biologically speaking, manure is really just unspent energy. The process begins with anaerobic digesters. These are essentially large, sealed, oxygen-free tanks. You take local biological waste cow manure from a local dairy, leftover crop stocks, even food waste from a nearby municipality, and you pump it into these tanks.
Okay.
Inside, naturally occurring bacteria break down that organic matter. Because there's no oxygen, the byproduct of this bacterial digestion is a raw biogas, which is incredibly rich in methane.
Okay, so we have methane gas. But you can't just easily pump raw methane into a tractor, and it's notoriously difficult and dangerous to compress and store in large volumes, right?
Right. Handling gaseous fuel at scale requires massive, highly pressurized, and very expensive infrastructure. To make this work for a localized node, you really need a liquid fuel, something stable, energy-dense, and easy to store in standard tanks. And this is where the technological leap happens. They use a micro-GTL unit, GTL standing for gas to liquid.
Okay, wait. How does a machine turn a gas into a liquid without just freezing it? Like, what's actually happening inside?
It uses a chemical process called Fischer-Tropsch synthesis. It's actually fascinating. The chemistry was originally developed in Germany way back in the 1920s to make liquid fuel out of coal gas.
Really? That long ago?
Yeah. But now it's miniaturized. Inside the GTL unit, the raw biogas is first scrubbed of impurities and converted into syngas, which is a mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. Then, the syngas is fed into a reactor filled with a specific metal catalyst, often cobalt or iron.
Okay, tracking.
Under carefully controlled heat and pressure, the catalyst causes the carbon monoxide and hydrogen molecules to literally break apart and snap back together, linking up into long hydrocarbon chains.
It's like molecular Legos. It's physically rebuilding the chemical structure of the fuel.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And the resulting product is a high-grade, stable, liquid synthetic fuel. It's often referred to as ASF, or agri-synthetic fuel.
Now, I want to clarify something for you listening, because when people hear synthetic biofuel, they often think of like ethanol or low-grade biodiesel that gums up engines and requires special modifications to run. But this ASF is different, right? The playbook mentions it meets ASTM D975 standards. What does that actually mean for the hardware?
It is a critical distinction to make. Meeting ASTM D975 means this synthetic fuel is molecularly a drop-in replacement for conventional petroleum diesel. It is chemically indistinguishable to an engine.
Wow.
You can pour this ASF directly into a standard backup generator, a traditional delivery truck,
wow,
or a hybrid battery charging system without making a single modification to the engine. It burns cleaner, it has high energy density, and a single micro GTL unit can produce upwards of 45 barrels of this synthetic diesel a single day.
That is incredible. And there's a beautiful piece of engineering elegance here regarding thermal efficiency too, isn't there?
Yes. The heat loop. The Fischer-Tropsch process forcing those molecules to snap together is highly exothermic. It generates a significant amount of waste heat. In a legacy industrial plant, that heat is just vented out of a smokestack into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's completely lost energy.
Right, just warming up the sky.
But in the localized energy loop, the system captures that exhaust heat and pipes it directly back to the anaerobic digesters.
Oh, because the bacteria need heat.
Exactly. The bacteria in those digesters need to stay warm to function optimally, especially during, you know, harsh Midwestern winters. So the fuel synthesis process keeps the biological breakdown process at peak efficiency year-round. It's a perfectly closed thermal loop.
Nothing is wasted. That is so cool. Okay, so that's the biological pillar giving us high-density liquid fuel. Now let's look at the second pillar, the electrical loop. We need raw electricity for the swarms. But the traditional image of solar power is, you know, massive, sprawling solar farms that pave over hundreds of acres of usable topsoil with glass. A farmer isn't going to give up their prime growing land for panels.
And they absolutely don't have to. The node relies on vertical agrivoltaic fences. Instead of laying panels flat on the ground and shading out everything beneath them, these panels are mounted vertically, exactly like a fence running down the length of the field.
And they're bifacial, right, meaning they collect sunlight on both the front and the back.
Exactly. They catch the morning sun on one side and the afternoon sun on the other. Because they're vertical, they take up only about 2% of the total land footprint.
That's nothing.
But what's even more brilliant is the agronomic benefit. They're spaced about 7 meters apart. In the middle of summer, peak afternoon sun can actually cause heat stress to crops, forcing them to shut down photosynthesis just to conserve water.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. But these vertical fences provide just enough intermittent microshading during the hottest part of the day to keep the soil cooler, reduce water evaporation, and actually boost the crop yield in the lanes between the fences.
So the power generation actively helps the food generation. It's not a trade-off.
Not at all. And the lanes between these solar fences are perfectly sized for the swarm bots to navigate.
That is the synergy right there. The swarm bots are fully electric. They don't need to drive all the way back to a central barn to charge. They plug directly into docking stations attached to these solar fences out in the field.
Right. It is a zero-loss charge. The electricity goes straight from the panel into the battery, bypassing the massive inefficiencies of grid transmission or combustion engines entirely for their daily operations.
Okay, let's look at how these two pillars work together in a typical day. The electric bots handle the continuous, low-intensity daily tasks, like rolling up and down the lanes, doing laser weeding powered purely by the sun hitting the fences. But farming isn't always low-intensity. What happens during a massive, high-stress harvest cycle? Or what if it rains for a week and the sun just isn't shining?
That is when Ryo seamlessly shifts the energy load. If the solar fences can't keep up with the demand, the system automatically fires up the generators running on the stored liquid ASF, the synthetic diesel we made from the manure.
Ah, there's the backup.
Exactly. The generators rapidly top up the bot's batteries, and the heavy work continues without any interruption.
The elegance of this circular logic is just staggering when you zoom out. Think about it. The autonomous bot meticulously weeds the crop. The healthy crop is harvested and fed to the dairy cow. The cow digests it and produces manure. The manure is shoveled into the anaerobic digester.
Mm-hmm.
The digester produces biogas. The GTL unit uses heat and pressure to turn that gas into synthetic diesel. And that synthetic diesel goes into the generator to charge the very bot that is weeding the crop. It is literally a perpetual motion machine powered by biology.
It really is a marvel.
So practically speaking, what does this actually mean for the entrepreneur's bank account? Can this truly replace the corner gas station for a rural operation?
It doesn't just replace the gas station. It fundamentally changes the economic identity of the entrepreneur. They transition from being a helpless Christ taker to a sovereign market maker.
A market maker.
Yes. Let's look at the 24-hour operational cycle managed by the Ryo system. From 10 a.m. to 2.00 p.m., you have peak sun hours. The solar fences are generating maximum electricity. The bots prioritize charging their batteries during this window. When the sun goes down, the work doesn't stop.
Right, because they have the ASF.
Exactly. The bots continue to run straight through the night, pulling from their battery reserves or utilizing the synthetic fuel generators. By entirely eliminating the 15 to 20% OPEX drain that purchasing global diesel traditionally represents, and by converting what was previously an annoying liability like piles of waste manure into their primary energy asset, they have built an absolute economic fortress.
I am tracking all of this, and it is a masterpiece of efficiency. But if we play this out logically, we hit a fascinating crossroads. If your farm is humming along, generating synthetic diesel around the clock, and you are harvesting peak solar power every day, you are inevitably going to have a surplus. You're going to generate more energy than your swarm bots actually need to operate.
That is the inevitable and highly profitable reality of the node.
The obvious traditional thought is, great, I have extra electricity. I'll just hook up to the local utility grid and sell it back to them. But everything I'm reading in these reports suggests that is a terrible idea. Selling power back to the grid at wholesale utility rates means you're giving away your premium sovereign asset for absolute pennies on the dollar.
Right. It's a bad deal.
So if you don't sell it to the power company, how do you arbitrage that surplus energy for maximum profit?
This is where we transition from merely surviving to aggressively thriving. We have to introduce the concept of the Stark spread.
The spark spread, okay.
In legacy finance, the spark spread refers to the gross margin of a gas-fired power plant.
Yeah.
You know, the difference between the cost of the fuel and the price of the electricity it generates. But in the context of the sovereign node, it represents something much more dynamic. It represents the RIO system's ability to autonomously decide, minute by minute, the most profitable use of the generated energy.
Give me a hypothetical. Walk me through a Tuesday afternoon on the farm.
Okay. It's 2.00 p.m. on a sunny Tuesday. The solar panels are maxed out, but the BOD batteries are completely full. The manure digester is still churning out gas. The RIO system analyzes the current market variables. It looks at the global spot price of diesel. It looks at the local demand for electricity. And crucially, it looks at the demand for digital services.
Digital services.
Yes. It instantly decides, should this next kilowatt of energy go into the BOD batteries? No, they're full. Should it be synthesized into liquid ASF to store for winter? Or should it be routed immediately into high-margin compute services?
And high-margin compute services. Okay, this is the exact moment this deep dive takes a turn I absolutely did not expect when I started reading. We are talking about the edge compute barn. The entrepreneur literally takes an old, underutilized, drafty farm barn and converts it into a sovereign data vault. I have to admit, when I first read this, I laughed out loud. Why on earth would a farmer standing in a field in Nebraska build a data center?
I know, it sounds crazy. But to answer that, you have to look at what's happening in the global AI industry right now. Artificial intelligence models are becoming deeply integrated into highly sensitive, high-privacy industries. We're talking about healthcare networks managing patient records, legal firms analyzing confidential case files, and defense contractors working on classified schematics.
Right, big data.
These industries desperately need AI inference. They need the software to analyze their data, which requires massive amounts of physical compute power. But there is a massive crisis of trust.
Because they can't just send that data to the cloud.
Exactly. They absolutely cannot risk uploading a secure military blueprint or a patient's DNA profile to a public cloud server operated by a massive tech conglomerate. Public clouds are inherently vulnerable to network-wide breaches, corporate espionage, and constant surveillance. These high-privacy clients need what's called air-gapped security.
Air-gapped meaning physically disconnected.
Yes. They need servers that are physically disconnected from the public internet, isolated, and completely private.
Wait, hold on. You're losing me a bit here. Companies like Amazon, Google, and Microsoft spend literally billions of dollars building hyperscale data centers. They have armed guards, retinal scanners, redundant cooling systems the size of a city block. You expect the Department of Defense or a major hospital network to trust a server rack sitting next to a cow pasture. How can a rural setup possibly compete with Silicon Valley infrastructure?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, you'll see they aren't competing on volume or sleekness. They are competing on sovereignty, privacy, and energy independence.
Okay.
Think about it. A public cloud data center in Virginia is incredibly energy starved. It strains the local power grid. And if that grid goes down, the data center relies on finite diesel backups. Furthermore, it's a massive, highly visible target. The converted farm barn, on the other hand, is invisible. It's an air-gapped, highly secure private vault, and most importantly, it has its own unkillable independent power source.
The single.
Exactly. The rural entrepreneur uses the steady-state, ultra-reliable power generated by their GTL unit to run climate-controlled server racks inside this secure barn. And because they're generating the power, essentially at cost, from sunlight and manure, their overhead for running those power-hungry servers is staggeringly low. They lease this privacy compute space to those high-security industries.
And how do they cool the servers? Because I know servers run incredibly hot.
This is another brilliant thermal loop. They use liquid cooling systems for the server racks, and the hot water that comes off the servers is piped directly into the greenhouses or back into the anaerobic digesters to keep the bacteria warm.
Are you serious? The waste heat of the AI becomes the lifeblood of the biology.
Exactly. And because they offer this absolute privacy and energy stability, they can charge a massive premium. The reports show they earn 5 to 10 times more revenue per kilowatt hour routing their energy into these private servers than they would if they had just sold that electricity back to the utility grid.
Wow. So the value isn't the AI itself. It's the secure off-grid energy feeding the AI.
Precisely. The raw intelligence of AI, the generic chatbots, the language models, is rapidly becoming a cheap commodity. It is free or nearly free everywhere. We call this below the line. But secure, localized, sovereign energy paired with physical, private execution. That is above the line. That is the new premium economic moat.
And the physical monetization doesn't stop at data. There's another use case in the playbook that fascinated me. The JIT, or Just-in-Time Hardware Hub. Because we all know the global AI boom has created massive supply chain bottlenecks for specialized physical hardware.
Yes, components like printed circuit boards or PCBs, custom mounting brackets for sensors, specialized cooling rigs.
So the Sovereign node uses its excess energy and specifically the recaptured thermal heat from the GTL unit, which provides the perfect ambient environment for advanced manufacturing to run banks of 3D PCB printers and high-precision CNC machines right there in the barn. An urban tech firm in Chicago realizes they're missing a crucial custom bracket for a drone prototype. They place an order to the rural node. The node fabricates it using Sovereign energy and ships it out within 24 hours, completely bypassing the massive delays of overseas manufacturing.
It creates a highly resilient distributed manufacturing web. But there's one more monetization vector we must discuss, and it might be the most structurally disruptive of all, the Sovereign fuel station.
Right. Because if you scale up your biogas digester and you add a few more local food waste sources, you can produce far more liquid synthetic diesel than your swarm bots will ever need to use.
Exactly. Yeah. So what do you do with those extra barrels of ASTM-compliant ASF? You sell it, not to the global market, but to the local rural economy. You contract directly with local independent trucking and logistics companies or like school bus fleets.
Okay.
Because your cost of production is entirely fixed. Your sunlight and your manure don't suffer from inflation and is completely decoupled from the chaos of global oil markets, you can offer these trucking companies fixed 10-year contract rates.
So while the guy at the corner gas station is changing the price on his sign every Tuesday based on what OPEC is doing, you walk into a local logistics company and say, I will sell you diesel for the next 10 years at a flat rate of $3 a gallon, guaranteed.
It is an irresistible offer. It significantly undercuts global diesel prices during spikes. This does two things. First, it creates a massive, guaranteed, long-term revenue stream for the node. Second, it literally saves the local supply chain from bankruptcy. When fuel prices spike globally, local truckers are usually the first to go out of business. The rural entrepreneur becomes the anchor of local economic stability.
It is absolute economic empowerment. It takes the power completely out of the hands of Wall Street and puts it back in the dirt. But okay, let's bring this down to earth. I know you're listening right now thinking, this all sounds amazing. Laser robots, AI server barns, synthetic fuel stations. It sounds like science fiction. And more importantly, I don't have $3 million lying around to buy gas to liquid units, vertical solar fences, and racks of servers.
Right, the financial barrier seems impossible.
Exactly. How does a regular person, a regular farmer or rural developer, actually achieve this? This brings us to the tactical reality, the 90-day playbook.
This is where the brilliant engineering of the physical hardware meets the equally brilliant engineering of finance and regulatory policy. This playbook outlines a highly specific step-by-step architectural blueprint to build this Sovereign node without going bankrupt or getting trapped in red tape. It's executed in three distinct phases.
Let's walk through phase one. This covers the first 30 days. It's called the asset audit. And from what I read, the fundamental shift here isn't physical, it's mental.
It is a complete cognitive reframing. The rural entrepreneur must stop looking at their property through the lens of legacy agriculture. They have to stop treating their monthly utility bills and diesel costs as fixed, inevitable facts of life. They need to walk their property and identify their dormant feedstocks.
What does that look like practically?
They map out the optimal sun exposure on their acreage for the agrivoltaics. They calculate the precise volume of manure output from their livestock. They start making calls to the nearby town to see if they can source local municipal food waste to add to the digester.
Right.
Simultaneously, they sit down at their computer and learn the digital architecture of the Rios system. They are shifting their mindset from farmer to energy and data sovereign.
Okay, so the audit is done. They know what they have. Then we hit phase two, which covers days 31 to 60. This is where the magic happens. It's called financial engineering, or the bypass formula, because the absolute wrong move here is to walk into a traditional conservative agricultural bank and ask for a massive business loan to buy AI robots and a micro refinery.
Well, the bank would laugh you out of the room. They only understand collateralizing traditional tractors and land. So you bypass the bank entirely. Step one of this phase, you form a nonprofit community cooperative or you partner with a tax-exempt municipal entity.
Why a co-op? What is the strategic advantage there?
It unlocks a very specific and incredibly powerful mechanism in federal policy. specifically a provision in recent infrastructure legislation known as IRA direct pay under Section 6417.
Okay, I've heard of this, but how does it work?
Historically, federal incentives for green energy came in the form of tax credits. But if you're a small farmer who doesn't owe millions in taxes, a tax credit is essentially useless to you. You can't spend it. But under Section 6417, because they're structured as a tax-exempt co-op, they don't get a deduction. They get a direct cash reimbursement from the federal government.
Wait, actual cash?
A direct cash transfer. It can cover 30 to 50% of the total capital cost of the qualifying hardware, like the micro GTL unit, the battery storage, and the agrivoltaic fences.
That is massive. That direct cash injection instantly cuts the initial financial barrier in half. But what about the remaining 50%? 50% of a massive hardware installation is still a lot of money.
This is where they utilize a financing structure called Node as a Service, or NaaS. Instead of paying cash out of pocket, the co-op engages with specialized industrial integrators. These integrators agree to install the equipment in exchange for a revenue-based financing agreement.
Break that down for me. How does that look on paper?
The remaining balance of the hardware cost isn't paid like a traditional mortgage. It is paid off dynamically through the energy savings and the new revenue streams generated by the node itself, that spark spread we discussed earlier.
Oh, I see.
The integrator takes a cut of the profits from the AI compute barn or the synthetic diesel sales until the equipment is paid off. This means the rural entrepreneur can acquire a $150,000 piece of advanced infrastructure with near zero out-of-pocket cash up front.
It is financially brilliant. You use government direct pay to cover half, and you use the machine's own future profits to pay off the rest. But then we hit the final hurdle. Phase 3, days 61 to 90, the interconnection bypass. Now, normally, if you build a massive energy generation hub and you want to turn it on and connect it to the traditional grid, the local utility monopolies will just bury you.
They absolutely will. The utility companies see distributed energy as an existential threat to their centralized business model. Traditional grid interconnection queues can take 4 to 7 years. They'll demand endless impact studies, expensive grid upgrades, permit after permit. You will die waiting for permission to turn your machine on.
So how on earth does a small rural co-op bypass a multi-billion dollar utility lobby?
They employ a masterpiece of regulatory judo. They do not ask to backfeed their power into the grid to sell it. Instead, they secure critical infrastructure, or CI, status for their node.
How do they qualify for that?
By linking their new unkillable power hub to local essential emergency services. Remember, they're a community co-op. So they dedicate a portion of their highly stable, Cingus-backed electricity to run a localized medical clinic's secure AI diagnostic agent. Or they use their power to run the emergency mesh satellite internet system for the county fire department.
Oh, wow. So instead of going to the utility and saying, please let me join your club, you build an unsinkable lifeboat, you put a paramedic on it, and you dare the utility company to try and sink it. That is incredibly bold.
It is strategically unassailable. By designating the node as a critical microgrid or an emergency resilience center, local jurisdictions are legally obligated to grant priority permitting. It completely bypasses the massive utility delays. And here's the final move. Once the system is operational and stable, they configure Rios to go into what's called island mode.
Meaning they pull the plug.
They disconnect from the centralized grid entirely. They are physically severed from the vulnerability of the line. Now, if a massive utility company tries to bring in lawyers to legally block them or shut them down, the entrepreneur has the ultimate trump card. They can point out to the judge and the press that shutting down their node means effectively turning off the power to the local emergency medical response and crippling the fire communication networks for the entire region. The utility lobby is rendered entirely powerless.
Let's just summarize the executive financial shift that has occurred over these 90 days. We've taken an entrepreneur who was bleeding, let's say, $4,500 a month in grid utility bills and imported diesel costs, a pure agonizing outgoing loss. In 3 months, by utilizing co-op legal structures, federal direct pay cash reimbursements, and revenue-based financing, they have transformed that monthly drain into a $150,000 sovereign infrastructure equity position. They've completely leaped over the finance chasm and the regulatory interconnection chasm simultaneously.
What is truly remarkable is that they've decoupled themselves from entropy. They've transformed their physical property from a place that linearly consumes expensive, fragile external resources into a sovereign engine that continuously generates wealth, data privacy, and energy locally.
It has been a phenomenal journey unpacking this today. We started out looking at the extreme fragility of the line, those massive, soil-crushing 20-ton tractors hopelessly addicted to volatile global diesel markets and fragile supply chains. And we watched how the modern rural entrepreneur completely flipped the script. We explored the resilience of the node, deploying fleets of small 24/7 AI swarm bots that literally run on local cow manure and vertical solar fences.
It's a complete 180.
Yeah. We saw how capturing the waste heat and using the spark spread to convert old drafty barns into air-gap data centers creates an unbeatable financial hedge, allowing the farmer to sell absolute privacy and compute power at a massive premium to, like, the Defense Department. And we walked through exactly how regular people are building this entire system in 90 days using clutter, federal, direct pay strategies, and critical infrastructure hacks.
It is a comprehensive reimagining of the rural economy. But as we conclude, I want to introduce a final concept for you to mull over, because a shift this lucrative does not go unnoticed. We have to consider the looming threat of hyperscaler intervention.
Hyperscalers being the massive big tech companies, the right. Amazons, the Googles, the Metas of the world.
Exactly. As this localized sovereign model proves its incredible profitability, the inevitable threat is that big tech will attempt to swoop in and commoditize it. They might try to ship out standardized, proprietary, node-in-a-box solutions. They'll try to monopolize the RIOS software, lock down the hardware with restrictive terms of service, and effectively attempt to turn the sovereign rural entrepreneur right back into a simple, dependent consumer of a tech product.
Right. Just putting them back on a different kind of lit line. But everything we've discussed today points to an ultimate ironclad defense against that intervention, doesn't it?
It does. And it comes back to physical reality. Big tech can write all the advanced code they want in Silicon Valley. They can design the sleekest AI agents and the most efficient neural networks. Mm. But they do not own the dirt. They do not own the localized sunlight hitting the acreage in Iowa. And they certainly do not own the biological waste coming out of the dairy farm.
The rural developer holds the physical keys.
Precisely. They control the above-the-line physical economy. The raw AI code is just free commodity fuel. But the execution of that AI, the power to run it, and the physical space to secure it requires physical sovereignty. The ultimate tech monopoly in the coming AI era might not belong to a coder in a glass tower. It might just belong to the farmer who successfully controls the localized energy loop.
That is a staggering thought to end on. The balance of power is shifting back to the physical world. To everyone listening, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. I want to leave you with this. The next time you drive past a rural farm, look closely at it. Look at the manure, look at the open space, feel the sun on your arm. Stop seeing it as just background scenery or traditional agricultural liability. Start seeing it for what it truly is. Massive amounts of dormant infrastructure just waiting for the right node to activate it. It makes you wonder, the next time you see that $500,000 giant tractor sitting in a field, are you looking at the pinnacle of modern farming, or are you just looking at a dinosaur waiting for the swarm?